Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we have reports from Mario Ritter, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. And we close the show with part three of Edgar Allan Poe's story, William Wilson. But first, federal officials in the United States reportedly are investigating child sexual abuse inside the Roman Catholic Church. The Associated Press reports that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has officially demanded documents and statements from church leaders in Pennsylvania. The orders were presented to church officials last week, the AP says. In August, a grand jury released a report about such accusations. The report accused 301 priests in Pennsylvania of sexually abusing more than 1,000 children over 70 years. It also said that high-level church officials hid the activities to protect the accused. Federal government lawyers, called prosecutors, are now taking action. That is what two people who were not permitted to discuss the investigation told AP. They spoke to the AP on the condition that the news group would keep their identities secret. Marcy Hamilton is a University of Pennsylvania professor and leader of Child USA, a nonprofit research group for child abuse prevention. She said such action would be important. The federal government has so far been utterly silent on the Catholic cases, she added. U.S. Attorney William McSwain of Philadelphia released the orders for the documents and statements by Catholic officials. He said he wants to know if officials such as priests, bishops, seminarians, or other Catholic leaders carried out any federal crimes. Such crimes could include taking children across state lines for illegal purposes, sending sexual images or messages electronically, or ordering anyone not to contact police. McSwain also said he wants to know if Catholic officials moved suspected abusers to other areas or used money or other possessions as part of such wrongdoing. The order seeks private church records. The AP's unidentified individuals said government lawyers are also seeking records on the local church's organization and finances. Details of where clergy worked and the treatment of priests are also being sought. The Pennsylvania grand jury report was almost 900 pages. It found that church leaders systematically hid evidence of wrongdoing. However, the report said only two priests could be charged because of time limits on legal action for such crimes. Many accused priests had already died.
Britain's Prince Harry is in Australia to open the fourth ever Invictus Games. The international competition is for military members and veterans wounded in battle. Prince Harry, also known as the Duke of Sussex, helped start the event in 2014 after attending a similar competition for wounded veterans in the United States. The prince himself served in the British Armed Forces for 10 years. The Duchess of Sussex and Prince Harry's wife, Meghan Markle, is also in Australia. The two are making their first royal tour with great media attention. They announced Monday they are expecting their first child. Invictus means undefeated in Latin. The games bring together more than 500 competitors from 18 countries, including Afghanistan, France, Iraq, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Earlier Invictus Games were held in England, the United States, and Canada. After arriving in Australia, the prince thanked the Australian government for holding the event. Australia is, of course, home to some of the world's best sporting talent. But what you are about to see during these Invictus Games will be a demonstration of the power of sport to change lives, he said. Former Australian military officer Gary Robinson was in a Black Hawk helicopter when it crashed in enemy territory in 2010 in Afghanistan. He suffered a brain and back injury. He also lost part of his left leg. Now he is getting ready to compete in his fourth Invictus Games. He will compete in the sports of cycling, archery, and swimming. "I am very honored," Robinson said. "Invictus saved my life." Amazon recently announced it would become an official supporter of the 2018 Invictus Games, which are being held in Sydney. It also supported the 2017 Invictus Games in Toronto, Canada. Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos said the company is committed to employing veterans. In a statement, Bezos said, "We find that their experience leading people is invaluable in our fast-paced work environment." The Invictus Games run from October 20th through 27th. Many of the events will be held in the same building used for the 2000 Olympics, which were also held in Sydney. I'm Susan Shane.
In Japan, very small automobiles traditionally were meant for families seeking a low-cost form of transportation. But these mini-cars, also known as K-cars, have instead become popular with another group of drivers, older adults. Car makers have hoped that by adding high-technology equipment, young people could be persuaded to buy mini cars. Yet the number of Japanese drivers under age 30 has fallen by nearly 40% since 2001. Mini cars are not costly. Prices start at about $7,500, and ownership taxes are low. For those reasons, the cars have gained a loyal following among Japan's growing number of elderly. Many of them very often earn about the same amount of money from one year to the next. One out of every three passenger cars sold in Japan is a mini car. Some industry experts are predicting that automated cars, taxis, and buses will keep older people active later in life. But until those high-tech products become a reality, K-cars are likely to continue to be popular in Japan, a country with an aging population. The Reuters news agency recently spoke with Hideaki Takaishi, a safety engineer at Honda. He said that one safety device uses sensors to observe a vehicle's surroundings and identify whether the driver has pressed the wrong pedal. Car makers also are trying to develop artificial intelligence systems that can advise drivers. Such advice could include warnings about safety risks, such as if the vehicle is moving toward the side of the road. Takaishi said systems like this will help older drivers. They really want to maintain their independence while they're driving, and it's a skill they've honed over many years, he said. In Japan, the number of people aged 60 and older with a driver's permit is growing faster than in other developed countries. In many rural areas, some people are driving into their 80s and 90s. This has led to increased traffic accidents for older drivers, although the total number of accidents is decreasing. Last year, the elderly were involved in 55% of Japan's traffic accidents. To deal with the problem, Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry launched a program to support safety technologies. The program provides a logo that manufacturers can use to identify cars with the new safety aids. People buying such cars can save on accident insurance. The safety technology may only increase the popularity of Japan's K cars. I'm Mario Ritter.
A group of six women decided to climb Africa's highest mountain in an effort to bring public attention to a physical condition they share. The women suffer from albinism, a genetic condition in which a person's skin, hair, and eyes lack pigmentation. One of the main signs of albinism is lighter than usual skin color. Other signs can include white hair and pink eyes. Many people with the condition also have problems with their eyesight and are extremely sensitive to sunlight. The six women set out to climb Tanzania's Mount Kilimanjaro earlier this month. The climb for albinism aimed to raise the visibility of women with albinism. They wanted to prove that women with the condition are not afraid to face difficult challenges. All the climbers say they have suffered discrimination and abuse because of their albinism. There are widely held stereotypes about the condition in some African nations. Some of these are based on incorrect beliefs or superstition. In some countries, women who give birth to babies with albinism are rejected by their husbands and families. Sometimes children with the condition are not accepted by their parents. Many children and adults with albinism are socially rejected. Nodumo Unkomanzi was one of the climbers. She told VOA that growing up in Zimbabwe, discrimination for people with albinism was not as bad as in some other countries. However, she said she suffered regular abuse.
I was very much made fun of at school. I was harassed typically in public and just walking across the street.
Even with these problems, Unkomanzi graduated from Yale University in the United States and now works in education. Mount Kilimanjaro is 5,895 meters high and is a difficult climb for anyone. But reaching the top can be even more difficult for people with albinism. Unkomanzi said she never faced extreme physical conditions like those she experienced during her climb of Kilimanjaro. They included having to deal with intense sunlight and having problems seeing along the way, Unkomanzi said. Another climber was Mariamu Stafford. She said she faced major problems throughout her life because of albinism. In one incident, she was attacked in her home by a group of men who cut off both her arms. Now, Stafford runs her own business in Tanzania. She said one problem she sees is that discussions of albinism in the media often deal with victimhood and pity. She hopes things like the climb for albinism can help change incorrect images of people with the condition.
And we wanted to show that we are more capable of accomplishing and succeeding in challenges that go far beyond the stereotypes that we are usually attached to.
Four of the climbers reached a camp at 4,700 meters before deciding to stop on medical advice. The other two, Unkomanzi and her Kenyan teammate, Jane Waitera, continued the climb. But Waitera had to stop 20 meters short of the top because of a knee injury. So, in the end, Unkomanzi was the one to represent the whole team. She reached the top of Mount Kilimanjaro on October 7th. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now it is time for our program, American Stories.
William Wilson, Part 3.
You remember that in the last part of my story, I told of my experiences in my first school. I spoke of my early meetings with a boy who looked and behaved as I did, whose name was even the same as mine, William Wilson. I told of the night when I went to Wilson's room with a plan to hurt him. What I saw that night so frightened me that I left the room and the school forever. As I stood looking down at his sleeping form and face, I might have been looking at myself in a looking glass. It was not like this, surely not like this, that he appeared in the daytime. The same name, the same face, the same body, the same day of coming to school, and then his use of my way of walking, my manner of speaking. Was it in truth humanly possible that what I now saw was the result, and the result only, of his continued efforts to be like me? Afraid, I left the old school and never entered it again. After some months at home, doing nothing, I went to study at the famous school called Eton. I had partly forgotten my days at the other school, or at least my feelings about those days had changed. The truth, the terrible truth of what had happened there, was gone. Now I doubted what I remembered. Now I called the subject into my mind only to smile at the strength of the strange ideas and thoughts I had once had. My life at Eton did not change this view. The fool's life into which I carelessly threw myself washed away everything that was valuable in my past. I do not wish, however, to tell here the story of my wrongdoing, wrongdoing which went against every law of the school and escaped the watchful eyes of all the teachers. 3 years of this had passed, and I had grown much larger in body and smaller in soul. 3 years of wrongdoing had made me evil. One night I asked a group of friends who were as evil as I to come to a secret meeting in my room. We met at a late hour. There was strong drink, and there were games of cards, loud talking until the new day began appearing in the east. Warm with the wine and with the games of chance, I was raising my glass to drink in honor of some especially evil idea when I heard the voice of a servant outside the room. He said that someone had asked to speak with me in another room. I was delighted. A few steps brought me into the hall of the building. In this room no light was hanging, but I could see the form of a young man about my own height, wearing clothes like those I myself was wearing. His face I could not see. When I had entered, he came quickly up to me, and taking me by the arm, he said softly in my ear, "William Wilson." There was something in the manner of the stranger and in the trembling of his uplifted finger which made my eyes open wide. But it was not this which had so strongly touched my mind and heart. It was the sound of those two simple, well-known words, "William Wilson," which reached into my soul. Before I could think again and speak, he was gone. For some weeks I thought about this happening. Who and what was this Wilson? Where did he come from? And what were his purposes? I learned that for family reasons he had suddenly left the other school on the afternoon of the day I myself had left it. But in a short time I stopped thinking about the subject. I gave all my thoughts to plans for study at Oxford University. There I soon went. My father and mother sent me enough money to live like the sons of the richest families in England. Now my nature showed itself with double force. I threw aside all honor. Among those who spent too much money, I spent more, and I added new forms of wrongdoing to the older ones already well known at the university. And I fell still lower. Although it may not be easily believed, it is a fact that I forgot my position as a gentleman. I learned and used all the evil ways of those men who live by playing cards. Like such skilled gamblers, I played to make money. My friends trusted me, however. To them, I was the laughing but honorable William Wilson, who freely gave gifts to anyone and everyone, who was young and who had some strange ideas, but who never did anything really bad. For 2 years I was successful in this way. Then a young man came to the university, a young man named Glendinning, who, people said, had quickly and easily become very rich. I soon found him of weak mind. This, of course, made it easy for me to get his money by playing cards. I played with him often. At first, with the gambler's usual skill, I let him take money from me. Then my plans were ready. I met him one night in the room of another friend, Mr. Preston. A group of 8 or 10 persons were there. By my careful planning, I made it seem that it was chance that started us playing cards. In fact, it was Glendinning himself who first spoke of a card game. We sat and played far into the night, and at last the others stopped playing. Glendinning and I played by ourselves while the others watched. The game was the one I liked best, a game called Ecarte. Glendinning played with a wild nervousness that I could not understand, though it was caused partly, I thought, by all the wine he had been drinking. In a very short time he had lost a great amount of money to me. Now he wanted to double the amount for which we played. This was as I had planned, but I made it seem that I did not want to agree. At last I said yes. In an hour he had lost 4 times as much money as before. For some reason his face had become white. I had thought him so rich that losing money would not trouble him, and I believed this whiteness, this paleness, was the result of drinking too much wine. Now, fearing what my friends might say about me, I was about to stop the game when his broken cry and the wild look in his eyes made me understand that he had lost everything he owned. Weak of mind and made weaker by wine, he should never have been allowed to play that night. But I had not stopped him. I had used his condition to destroy him. The room was very quiet. I could feel the icy coldness in my friends. What I would have done, I cannot say, for at that moment the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened. Every light in the room went out. But I had seen that a man entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard his voice. In a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my bones, he said, "Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully." While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room. And as he ended, he was gone.
That is our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.